Chapter 47. During the next 6 months, more than 500 families from France, Belgium, and Canada came to our colony. My joy was much diminished, however, by the sudden news that Mr. Cajot had come back from France, where he spent only 1 month. Not daring to visit Bourbonnais again, he was lurking on the frontiers of Indiana, only a few miles distant. Driven to madness by his jealousy and hatred, he addressed to me on the 23rd of January, 1853, the most abusive letter I ever received, and ended it by telling me that the fine, though unfinished church of Bourbonnais, which he had built, was to be burned, and that my life would be in danger if I remained at the head of that mission. I immediately sent that letter to the bishop, asking his advice. In his answer, he told me that he thought that Mr. Cajot was wicked enough to fulfill his threats. He added, "Though I lack clear evidence, I fear that Mr. Lebel is united with Mr. Cajot in the diabolical plot of burning your church at Bourbonnais. Several people have reported that he says that your presence there will be the ruin of that people and the destruction of their church. I would advise you, my dear Mr. Chiniki, to ensure that church without delay. I have tried to do it here, but they have refused, under the pretext that it is an unfinished frame building, and that there are too many dangers of fire when people are still working at it." My impression is that Mr. Lebel is on intimate terms with some insurance gentlemen, and has frightened them by speaking of that rumor of which he is probably the father with that miserable Cajot. Perhaps you may have a better chance by addressing yourself to some insurance company at Joliet or Springfield. After vain efforts to insure the church, I wrote to the bishop, "The only way to escape the impending danger is to finish the church at once and insure it after. I have just made a collection of $400 among the people of Bourbonnais, to which I added $300 from my own private resources, and will go to work immediately if your lordship has no objections." He agreed, and we worked almost day and night till it was finished. I dare affirm that for a country place, that church was unsurpassed in beauty. The inside framework and altar was all made of the splendid black walnut, or black oak, of Bourbonnais, polished and varnished by most skillful men. It was late at night when we could say with joy the solemn words, "It is finished." Afterwards, we sung the Te Deum. Had I had opportunity at that late hour, I would have insured it, but I was forced to wait till the next Monday. The next day, the first Sabbath of May, 1853, the church had never been so crowded. The words of gratitude which I addressed to my God, when I thanked Him for the church He had given us, had never been so sincere and earnest. Alas, who would suspect that 6 hours later, that same people gathered around the smoking ruins of their church would rend the air with their cries of desolation? Such, however, was the case. After the public service, two little boys, who had remained in the church to wait for the hour of the catechism, ran to the parsonage crying, "Fire! Fire! Fire!" bareheaded and half paralyzed, I rushed to the church with a pail of water in hand, but it was too late. The flames were already running and leaping over the fresh varnish. In less than 2 hours, our beautiful church was gone. We had no doubt that this was the work of an incendiary, for we had left no fire in the church after the service. Though stunned by that awful calamity, the noble-hearted people of Bourbonnais did not lose their minds. As they gathered around the smoking ruins, I encouraged them that it was only in the midst of great trials and difficulties that men could show their noblest qualities and their true manhood. If we were true men, instead of losing our time in shedding tears and rending the air with our cries of desolation, we would immediately put our hands to the work the very next day to raise up a stone church which would not burn, but stand before God and man as an imperishable monument of their faith, indomitable courage, and liberality. We immediately started a collection in less than 1 hour, $4,000 in money and more than $5,000 in time, timber and stone and other material were pledged and faithfully given to erect that fine stone church of Bourbonnais. The next Thursday, Bishop Vandevelde came from Chicago to see what could be done to repair that terrible loss and to inquire confidentially of me as to the author of the fire. All the facts indicated that the miserable Courgeot, with Lebel, the French-Canadian priest of Chicago, had done it through their emissaries. No doubt of this remained in my mind when I learned that soon after Mr. Courgeot had thrown himself into one of those dark dungeons called the monastery of La Trappe. I had hoped my bishop would bring me words of encouragement. Instead, he said to me, "Mr. Dear Chiniki, I must reveal to you a thing that I have not yet made known to anyone. Please do not say a word about it until it is accomplished. I cannot remain any longer Bishop of Illinois. It is beyond my power to fulfill my duties. The conduct of the priests of this diocese is such that should I follow the regulations of the canon, I would be forced to interdict all my priests except you and 2 or 3 others. They are all either notorious drunkards or given to public or secret concubinage. Several of them have children by their own nieces and 2 by their own sisters. I do not think that 10 of them believe in God. Religion is nothing to them but a well-paying comedy. Where can I find a remedy to such a general evil? Can I punish one of them and leave the others free in their abominable doings? Would not the general indiction of these priests be the death blow of our church in Illinois? Besides, how can I punish them when I know that many of them are ready to poison me the very moment I raise a finger against them? I intend to go to Rome as soon as I receive my permit from the Pope to renounce at his feet the bishopric of Chicago, which I will not keep on any consideration. The awful responsibility of my position here, I cannot any longer endure it. I determined to wait till the next morning when I should have plenty of time. I hoped to expel his dark thoughts and give him more courage. Besides, I was myself so discouraged by those awful disclosures that I was in need of mental as well as bodily rest. But alas, the next day was to be one of the darkest of my priestly life. When the hour for breakfast came the next morning, I went to awaken the bishop. What was my dismay when I found him drunk? I had been told that Bishop Vandervelde was a drunkard, as well as the greater part of the bishops of the United States, but I had never believed it. The destruction of my dear church by the hands of incendiaries was surely a great calamity for me, but the fall of my bishop from the high position he had in my heart and mind was still greater. My love and respect for Bishop Vandervelde were very strong chains by which I was bound to the feet of the idols of Rome. I will eternally bless God for having himself broken these chains on that day of supreme desolation. The remaining part of the day I remained almost mute in his presence. He was not less embarrassed when he asked me my views about his project of leaving the diocese. I answered him in a few words that I could not disapprove the purpose, for I would myself prefer to live in a dark forest in the midst of wild animals than among drunken atheist priests and bishops. Some months later, I learned without regret that the Pope had accepted his resignation of the Bishop of Chicago and appointed him Bishop of Natchitoches in Louisiana. His successor in Chicago was Reverend O'Regan. One of the very first things which this new bishop did was to bring Bishop Vandervelde before the criminal tribunals as a thief, accusing him of having stolen $100,000 from the bishopric of Chicago. This action caused a terrible scandal, not only in Illinois, but through all the United States. The two bishops, employing the best lawyers to fight each other, came very near proving to the world that both of them were equally swindlers and thieves. When the Pope forced them to stop and bring the affair before his tribunal at Rome, there it was decided that the $100,000 taken from Chicago to the Natchitoches diocese should be equally divided between the two bishops. How many sleepless nights did the voice of my conscience cry out, "What are you doing here, extending the power of a church which is a den of thieves, drunkards, and impure atheists, a church governed by men whom you know to be godless swindlers and vile comedians? Do you not see that you do not follow the word of God, but the lying traditions of men, when you consent to bow your knees before such men? Is it not blasphemy to call such men the ambassadors and the disciples of the humble, pure, holy, peaceful, and loving Jesus? Come out of that church, break the fetters by which you are bound as a vile slave to the feet of such men. Take the gospel for thine only guide, and Christ for thine only ruler." In desolation, I found my faith in my church was, in spite of myself, shaken by these scandals. On my knees, I asked my God to preserve me, to preserve it from ruin. But I remained the whole night as a ship drifting on an unknown sea, without a compass or a rudder. Much later, I learned that the divine and sure pilot was directing my course towards the port of salvation. It seemed, though, I had been very busy finding homes for the new immigrants, that my duty was to go and pay my respects to my new bishop, and open to him my heart as to my best friend, and the guide whom God himself had chosen to heal the wounds of my soul with the oil and wine of charity. I will never forget the day, the 11th of December, 1854, when I saw Bishop O'Regan for the first time. He was of medium stature, with a repugnant face, and his head always in motion. All its motions seemed the expression of insolence, contempt, tyranny, and pride. There was absolutely nothing pleasant, either in his words or in his manners. I fell on my knees to ask his benediction and kissed his hand, which seemed as cold as a corpse. Ah, you are Father Chenecky, he said. I am glad to see you, though you have deferred your visit a long time. Please sit down. I want some explanation from you about a certain very strange document which I have just read today. And he went at the double quick to his room to get the document. There were two Irish priests in the room, who came a few minutes before me. When we were alone, one of them said, "We had hoped that we would gain by changing Bishop Vandeveld for this one, but my fear is that we have only passed from Charybdis unto Cecilia." And they laughed outright, but I could not laugh. I was more inclined to weep. The bishop returned holding in his hand a paper, which I understood to be the deed of the 11 acres of land which I had purchased and built my chapel of St. Anne. "Do you know this paper?" he asked me in an angry manner. "Yes, my lord, I know it," I answered. But then he quickly replied, "You must know that title is a nullity, a fraud, which you ought never to have signed. Your venerable and worthy predecessor has accepted it," I answered. "I do not care a straw about what my predecessor has done," he abruptly answered. "We have not to deal with my Lord Vandeveld, but with a document which is a nullity, a deception, which must be thrown in the fire. You must give me another title of that property." And saying this, he flung my deed on the floor. I calmly picked it up and said, "I exceedingly regret, my lord, that my first interview with your bishop, your lordship, should be the occasion of such an unexpected act, but I hope that this will not destroy the paternal sentiments which God must have put into the heart of my bishop for the last and least of his priests. I see that your lordship is very busy. I do not want to trespass on your valuable time. I take this rejected document with me to make another one, which I hope will be more agreeable to your views," and I then took my departure. It seemed that my most pressing duty after my first interview was to bring my heart nearer to my God than ever, to read and study my Bible with more attention, and to get my people to take more than ever the Word of God as their daily bread. I began also to speak more openly of our Christian rights as well as of our duties, as these are set forth in the Gospels of Christ. Sometime before this, I had respectfully sent my resignation of Bourbonnais to the bishop, which had been accepted. A priest had been called by him to take my place there, but he too was ere long guilty of a public scandal with his servant girl. The principal citizens of Bourbonnais protested against his presence in their midst and forced the bishop to dismiss him. His successor was the miserable priest Lebel, who had been turned out of Chicago for a criminal offense with his own niece, and was now to be the curate of Bourbonnais. But his drunkenness and other public vices caused him to be interdicted and expelled from that place in the month of September 1855. About the same time, a priest who had been expelled from Belgium for a great scandal was sent to Kankakee as the curate of the French Canadians of that interesting young city. After his expulsion from Belgium, he had come to Chicago, where under another name he had made a fortune, and for 5 or 6 years kept a house of prostitution. Tired of that, he offered $5,000 to the bishop if he would accept him as one of his priests and give him a parish. Bishop O'Regan, being in need of money, accepted the gift and sent him to Kankakee. Soon he came with Mr. Lebel to pay me a visit. I received them politely as possible, though they were both half drunk when they arrived. After dinner they went to shoot prairie chickens and got so drunk that one of them, Mr. Lebel, lost his boots in the slough and came back barefooted without noticing his loss. I had to help them get into their carriage, and the next day I wrote them forbidding them to ever set foot in my house again. But what was my surprise and sadness, not long before these two infamous priests were ignominiously turned out by their people, to receive a letter from my bishop which ended in these words: "I am sorry to hear that you refuse to give on good terms, to live on good terms with your two neighboring brother priests. This ought not to be, and I hope to hear soon that you have reconciled yourself with them." It came to be a public fact that the bishop had said before many people, "I would give anything to the one who would help me to get rid of that unmanageable Chiniki." Among those who heard the bishop was a land shark who had been found guilty of perjury in Iroquois County. He was very angry against me for protecting my poor countrymen against him. He said to the bishop, "If you pay the expense of the suit, I pledge myself to have Chiniki put in jail." The bishop had publicly answered him, "No sum of money will be too great to be delivered from a priest who alone gives me more trouble than the rest of my clergy." This speculator dragged me before the criminal court of Kankakee on the 16th day of May, 1855, but he lost his action and was condemned to pay the cost. It was my impression that the bishop, having so often expressed in public his bad feelings against me, would not visit my colony, but I was mistaken. On the 11th of June, taking the Reverend Mr. Lebel and Carceval for his companions, he came to St. Anne to administer the sacrament of confirmation. In private, I energetically protested the presence of these two degraded men in my house. "My Lord, allow me respectfully to tell you that the gospel of Christ tells us to avoid the company of publicly vicious and profligate men. My conscience tells me that through respect for myself and my people, and through respect for the gospel I preach, I must avoid the company of men, one of whom has lived with his niece as his wife, and the other has till very lately been guilty of keeping a house of prostitution in Chicago. Your Lordship may ignore these things, and in consequence of that may give your confidence to these men, but nothing is more apt to destroy the faith of our French Canadian people than to see such men in your company when you come to administer the sacrament of confirmation. It is through respect for your Lordship that I take the liberty of speaking thus." He angrily answered me, "I see it is true what people say about you. It is the gospel you constantly appeal, the gospel. The gospel is surely a holy book, but remember that it is the church which must guide you, Christ has said, "Hear my church. I am here, the interpreter, ambassador, the representative of the church. When you disobey me, it is the church you disobey. Now, my Lord, that I have fulfilled a conscientious duty, through respect for your lordship, I will deal with those priests as if they were worthy of the honorable position you have given them." All right," replied the bishop, "but it must be near the hour of dinner." "Yes, my lord, I have just heard the bell calling us to the dining room." After the blessing of the table by the bishop, he looked at the Reverend Cowsbell, who was sitting just before him, and said, "What is the matter with you, Mr. Cowsbell? You do not look well." "No, my lord," he answered, "I am not well. I want to go to bed." He was correct, he was not well, for he was drunk. During the public services he had left the chapel to come down and ask for a bottle of the wine I kept to celebrate Mass. The housekeeper, thinking he wanted the wine in the chapel, handed him the bottle, which he drank in her presence in less than 5 minutes, after which he went to the chapel to help the bishop in administering the confirmation to the 150 people I had prepared for the reception of that rite. As soon as dinner was finished, the bishop requested me to take a walk with him. After giving me some compliments on the beauty of the site I had chosen for my first village and chapel, he saw at a short distance a stone building which was raised only a little above the windows. On directing his steps towards it, he stopped only 20 or 30 feet distance and asked me, "Whose house is this?" "It is mine, my lord." "It is yours," he replied. "And to whom does that fine garden belong?" "It is mine also, my lord." "Well, well," he rejoined, "where did you get the money to purchase that fine piece of land and build that house?" "I got the money where every honest man gets what he possesses, in my hard labor and in the sweat of my brow," I replied. "I want that house and that piece of land," rejoined the bishop with an imperative voice. "So do I," I replied. "You must give me that house with the land on which it is built," said the bishop. "I cannot give them as long as I am in need of them, my lord," I replied. "I see that you are a bad priest, as I have often been told, since you disobey your bishop," he rejoined with an angry manner. I replied, "I do not see why I am a bad priest because I keep what my God has given me." "Are you ignorant of the fact that you have no right to possess any property?" he answered. "Yes, my lord, I am ignorant of any law in our holy church that deprives me of any such rights. If, however, your lordship can show me any such law, I will give you the title of that property just now." "If there is not such a law," he replied, stamping on the ground with his feet, "I will get one passed." "My lord," I replied, "you are a great bishop. You have a great power in the church, but allow me to tell you that you are not great enough to have such a law passed in our holy church." "You are an insolent priest," he answered with terrible anger, "and I will make you repent for your insolence." He then turned his face toward the chapel without waiting for my answer, and ordered the horses to be hitched to the carriage, that he might leave in the shortest possible time. A quarter of an hour later, he had left St. Anne, where he was never to come again. The visit of that mitred thief, with his two profligate priests, though very short, did much by the mercy of God to prepare our minds to understand that Rome is the great harlot of the Bible, which seduces and intoxicates the nations with the wine of her prostitution.